Tonight, of course, we have the Honorable Judge Barbara M. G. Lin. As many of you know, Judge Lin is the first female member of the hall. She graduated summa cum laude from UVA with a degree in American history, a minor in Russian history as well. She attended law school at Southern Methodist University, where she graduated first in her class. Before she took the oath of office of the United States District Judge for Northern District of Texas in 2000, she was in part of the Dallas law firm of Carrington Coleman, Sloan and Blumenthal, LLP, and remained there until she took the bench. She was named a partner in the firm in 1983 and served on the firm's executive committee from 1983 to 1999. Judge Lin served as the 1988 to 1999 chair of the American Bar Association section of litigation and received SMU Law School's Distinguished Alumni Award for Private Practice in 1999. She was the first recipient of the Louise Raggio Award given by the Dallas Women Lawyer Association for contributions to her profession. She was listed in the Best Lawyers in America in Business Litigation from 1994 to 1999. And in 2006, she was recognized by the women in the law section of the State Bar of Texas as the Sarah T. Hughes Women Lawyer Achievement. Judge Lin has been serving as the adjunct professor at SMU's Dedman School of Law and as fellow committee chairman of the American College of Trial Lawyers. Judge Lin is married to Michael F. Lin, a Dallas trial lawyer who was also, at his time, the society, the vice president. So we are all enormously proud of the membership of Judge Lin. And with that, let me join me as we introduce the Honorable Barbara M. G. Lin of the state of Texas.
Members of the society and Lord Slynn in particular, it's my great privilege and honor to be with you. I am not giving the speech that was advertised. I'm going to give a slightly different one, but I will cover that topic. But I'm going to begin with just some miscellaneous remarks. I was telling Jessica earlier this evening that my entire experience as an undergraduate at the university was affected by my association with the society. Almost all good. There were a few rough moments, which I talked about last time, so I won't dwell on, but my experience with the hall and with the members of the hall was really one of the high points of my life. I learned a great deal here. I think I made a difference, a positive difference, and I treasure my memories of it, and I compliment all of you on your wisdom in associating with an institution that has so much to offer. So I thank you all very, very much for the courtesy of inviting me to speak to you. I thought that I would make some remarks that are essentially a reflection on my 7 years as a judge. I had intended to limit my remarks to the subject of judicial discretion, and I will talk about that subject, but I thought perhaps you might prefer to just hear miscellaneous thoughts that I have from sitting on the side of the bench where I do. I practiced law for almost 25 years before I became a judge, and if you were appearing before me, you would immediately say, "Judge, you cannot possibly be old enough to have practiced 25 years." That's the kind of thing that lawyers say to me all the time. It's spectacular. I told my husband, "I am not going to the gym anymore because I look great and I'm always going to look great no matter what." So that's one thing that I will tell you. You get a lot of compliments, and you need to have an honest spouse to tell you when you don't deserve them, because lawyers appear before you and just could not flatter you more, although they try. I had a case early on. I had four sets of lawyers. The first lawyer began his remarks, and they were very serious and to the point and very well done. And he finished his remarks, and I made some comments and asked some questions, and he answered them and responded to them. And then the second lawyer stood up to make his remarks, and I asked a question, and he responded, "Well, I might as well just stop now. Judge, you have a complete handle on this. That is the question." Of course. And the third lawyer began his remarks, and I made a comment, and he said, "If I were you, that is what I would have said. That is the essence of our position." And then the fourth lawyer argued, and something similar happened. And I said to the first lawyer, "In the interest of fairness, I will now give you 15 seconds for some shameless sucking up. And he said, you really look good, Judge. And I said, score. So the job has a lot of redeeming aspects to it. I engage fully with the lawyers. I do not just sit there like a bump on the log. I ask a lot of questions. I make a lot of comments. I have a good exchange with the lawyers. I very much enjoyed practicing law. I miss being an advocate. But there are occasions when my desire to, if not be an advocate, at least engage in a conversation at a high level of intellect and back and forth manifests itself. There are many opportunities for hearings in my court. Many federal judges do not have hearings. I have a lot of hearings because I enjoy seeing the lawyers. I find the exchange to be helpful in deciding matters. And I also try cases without juries when the jury's waived. And in those non-jury cases, I am not the same judge that I am in a jury trial. In a jury trial, I respect very much the fact that the lawyers are the advocates and it's their job to put on evidence and ask questions and not my job to interfere with that, and I don't. But in a non-jury case, I'm the trier of fact as well as the judge, and I can ask any question I want, and I do. And sometimes witnesses that think they got off pretty well after cross-examination have not been cross-examined by me yet. So I keep my skills sharp, and so some people don't waive the jury if they don't want that kind of scrutiny because I involve myself in a significant way in those cases. It is my experience reflecting on what it's like on this side of the bench is that this job is a lot harder than it looks. When I was a lawyer, I wondered, why is it taking that judge so long to decide? And now I'm asking myself, why is it taking me so long to decide? Issues that are presented to me every day are very hard and surprisingly very close, and very often there is no answer. And so it requires me to employ what I think is the quality and characteristic that is most important to a judge. No surprise, it is judgment. Because there is not a book where you can look up the answer and find it. And most of the questions that I have, not just a few of them, but most of the questions I have are very complicated. And there are either cases on the subject that argue for opposing results, or there are no cases at all. And so often I just have to apply my best judgment. I try to do so without letting any personal political preferences interfere. But we bring to the task of judging our whole selves. You can't check it at the door. You bring all of your talent and experience and orientations to the job, but of course the principal thing that good judges must do is to have a fealty to the law, and I try to do that. I think that anyone that reads my opinions and watches me will have a hard time figuring out what my politics are, and that's as it should be. The task of judging is not a science. It is an art. And an art that I and other judges that I know practice at every day. I will tell you that judges are not uniformly great. If anyone has been watching the debacle on TV, I will not point to the judge in particular. One will agree with me that the quality of judging is not uniformly great. One would like to think that every time you see a judge on TV, you would leave having a feeling of great confidence, but regrettably, that is not so. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why in federal courts, we do not have cameras in the courtroom. I personally do not agree with that. I would like to see it, but I understand the arguments against it. I think that federal judges, because they are appointed essentially for life, that's the phrase appointed for life does not appear in the Constitution, but essentially we are appointed for life. And that is a liberating factor that I think would mitigate the prospect that federal judges would play to the camera. However, you might have read that last week, Justice Kennedy, uniquely so, appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and had a very interesting exchange with Senator Spector, who is very much in favor of cameras in the courtroom, about that subject. And somewhat to my surprise, Justice Kennedy expressed a concern that his colleagues on the Supreme Court of the United States would at least be affected by the presence of a camera in terms of the candor of argument and what questions they would feel they should or should not ask with the camera running. I have more confidence in the process than that, and I think it would be a very useful endeavor for people to develop confidence in our courts to be able to observe the Supreme Court in oral argument. I think that is a very impressive endeavor, and were the citizens of this country, I don't think many of them would tune in, but those who would, I think, would be enriched by the experience and would conclude that the institution is in fine shape indeed. There are, of course, arguments to be made that at the trial level, cameras can interfere with the administration of justice, that particularly in a jury trial, one would not want to have the jurors' images broadcast on television, and you would not want to have witnesses concerned about having their images broadcast. But there are ways to protect that if you wanted to do it. I am personally of the view that broadcasting appellate arguments would not have significant risk and would indeed enhance the administration of justice. But we don't have it in federal court, and I think there is not much sentiment in the judiciary to change that. Congress may, in its wisdom, decide to adopt rules for it, but ultimately I think that the most that Congress will do is make it discretionary, and I see no sentiment that the Judicial Conference of the United States will approve cameras in the courtroom, so I do not see it coming. My experience, though, generally speaking, as I began to say, is that judges that I know at every level are hardworking, intelligent, dedicated administrators of the law. I do not see people that I think have a personal agenda. I do not see, and I will say some more about this later, quote, judicial activists. I do not see people that, again, there are some exceptions, but I'm speaking generally, and I have a great deal of experience with judges at different levels. I see Democrats who are on the bench. I see Republicans on the bench. And I see decision-making that is independent of that kind of political affiliation. The most important thing, of course, about our judiciary is that the public have confidence that judges are fair and impartial. And in my experience, the vast majority of judges with whom I come into contact are exactly that. And the American people, I think, need to know that judges will not be influenced by political pressure and that they will make informed, fair, and independent decisions. And although the standing of judges has declined, as has the standing of lawyers declined, I think it is still the case, and the polling confirms this, that our judicial institutions are generally well regarded. Until we have the death of a celebrity, well, they will undoubtedly drop, I hope, for a brief period of time. It is true, I think, and I was impressed when Chief Justice, now Chief Justice Roberts, said this at his confirmation hearing, because I share this view, that really the role of a judge is to act as an umpire. And as he said, the umpires don't make the rules. They apply the rules of the game, and the role of an umpire, like a judge, is critical. They make sure that everyone plays by the rules, but it is a limited role, and nobody comes to the ball game to see the umpire. And that is true. I say sometimes, not all the time, but at least in a jury trial, except for the judge ruling on the evidence, it is in some part like a waiter at a fine restaurant. That waiter at a fine restaurant does not introduce himself as George, I'll be taking care of you. He just brings you your food, your dessert, and your bill. And a good judge, in my judgment, runs the courtroom but leaves the lawyers with room to try their case. And that's what I try to do and try not to get in the way of that. Of course, when lawyers cross the line, my job is to make sure, as the umpire, to make sure that the rules are enforced, and that's what I do. As I said, the job of judging is a difficult one. It's difficult at every level. I'll tell you a little bit about what I think is the most difficult aspect of what I do, and that is sentencing people who commit crimes. It is the most difficult thing that I do. I have made it my business to try to mentor young people, and most of them have been women who have been interested in making a career in the law. So I have a set of friends who are the same age as my children and a little bit older. And one of them came by the other day to visit and asked me to compare the experience I have in sentencings to the similar amount of time that I spend in every other matter that I handle. And I said that I can be on the bench for 4 hours sentencing defendants, and I can be on the bench for 10 hours trying a civil lawsuit, and that 4 hours will feel three times as difficult as the 10 hours I was in a civil case. It just gets to the very core of you, and in my view, it should feel exactly that way. Because every day when I send people to the penitentiary, and many of them richly deserve to go, there are victims in the courtroom who are not the direct victims of the crime, but the indirect victims, the families of the defendants, who beg and plead and cry. And sometimes they're men crying. And I don't mean this to sound sexist, but there is something about a man sobbing that is just very difficult to watch. But the thing to do, I make note once more of the case that is entertaining us all, is not for the judge to sob and weep. The judge just has to observe, be empathetic, and carry on, difficult as it is. Were I to make sentencing determinations based upon the effect of what I do on others, I could not do my job. And the person that needs to have concerned himself or herself with the effect of wrongdoing on others is the wrongdoer. But that notwithstanding, I am a human, I am not a machine. And when I had a case with three illegal aliens who were working at very low-level jobs because they were illegal aliens, and only those kinds of employers typically don't check I-9s, and went to have a beer after work, had no criminal records, were each offered $500 to unload crates from a truck. And of course, they took the money and they did it, and all of those crates were full of drugs. And they came before me with, even after an adjustment under the sentencing guidelines, they were going to get from me an absolute minimum of 5 years in prison, and then they were all going to be deported. And between them, they had 9 children under the age of 5, and they were all lined up in the front row. And that was very hard. Now, I did it. I didn't cry about it, but I felt it all. And that's the job that I have to do, and that's what I get paid the small bucks, as I say, to do. So it is a very, very difficult job. And it is here that I will say a few words about discretion. For those of you who are not law students, you may not have followed the Booker decision, and I won't bore you with too much detail about it, but essentially the law is now that we have more discretion. I'm just going to make this overly simplistic. We have more discretion in sentencing than we did before the Booker decision. because the sentencing guidelines of the United States are no longer considered mandatory. They are considered to be exactly what they say they are, which is guidelines. It is the case, I will say as an aside, that we federal judges are not departing from those guidelines terribly aggressively. The statistics indicate that we are departing from them more than we did before, but we're not departing wholesale from them. And the reality of it is that I think judges are mindful of the fact that Congress may take away that discretion that we have if we use it excessively. There is no science to that statement. It is just an observation. But there are many cases where a rote application of guidelines leads to an unjust result. You might or might not know that the sentencing guideline scheme, which is, I'll tell you who don't know about it, that it's actually math. We have a chart. We run our fingers down one way across the other. Offense level, criminal history, sentencing range. And it was a liberal idea. Senator Kennedy was particularly involved in it, that uniformity of sentencing for similar crimes was advisable, and that without it, there would be unjust and inequitable sentencings that would very likely, based on history, adversely affect minority defendants. That was the origin of it. That is not a silly idea. There was certainly data to suggest that those concerns were fair. There were geographical differences from place to place about how certain crimes were punished. And I think there were well-motivated people that were very much in favor of it. But the truth of the matter is that when you sit where I sit, you quickly realize that two defendants, although they commit the same crime, are not the same. That there are differences that matter, that are often intangible, that cannot be measured on a chart moving your finger across the page. And I submit to you that what people in this country, and Congress in particular, should want is judges with good judgment who will be mindful of the necessity for not forgetting what one did yesterday, for not ignoring what one is considering as a punishment for a similar crime, but not being constrained not to exercise that characteristic, which, again, I say, is the most important, and that is good judgment. I would similarly comment that the trend in this country toward more and more mandatory minimum sentences is, I think, also counter to picking judges who you think have that quality of good judgment. Because when I had a case with these three individuals, for example, who certainly had involved themselves in a serious offense, but that I could not apply my judgment to see what was an appropriate sentence under those circumstances, but was required to apply as a mandatory minimum sentence, I felt like I was handcuffed from doing the job that I am there to do. So I think you will not find many judges who would stand up and advocate for mandatory minimum sentences because they sometimes cause a result that is unjust and unfair, and I certainly would not be an advocate for that. I alluded earlier to the topic of judicial activism, and I could give a speech. I will suggest that anyone who hasn't given a probationary speech, this would be a great probationary speech on judicial activism. I just want to say to you that Justice Scalia, who is my circuit justice for the Fifth Circuit, said, and I agree with him completely, that the term is, quote, totally imprecise, close quote, and, quote, nothing but fluff, close quote. I have no idea what it means. What would you like to have? Judicial passivity? What does that mean? I have to act. That is my job. And I think it is a proxy for, I didn't like what you decided. I'm going to give you a statistic that I think that you will find surprising. I'll take liberty of asking a question. Joe, I'll direct the question to you. What justice do you think, when the statistics were compiled in 2005, was most involved, what was the judge who most frequently voted to overturn congressional enactments on the Supreme Court?
I would guess Clarence Thomas.
Well, that's correct. Well, that would not have been my guess. And Joe, since you're doing so well, who do you think was the justice who voted least often to reverse congressional enactments? Fifty percent is still an F, Joe. No, it was Justice Breyer. And the four justices who voted least often to reverse congressional enactments were Justice Breyer, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Stevens, and Justice Souter. So, what does judicial activism mean? Someone said it means judges behaving badly. Justice Marshall, I think, was a judicial activist, if that term has any meaning. Marbury versus Madison might be the grandfather of judicial activism. Ron Paul, who is a congressman from Texas, said that it's judges ignoring the law and deciding cases based on their personal political views. I think it is a term usually used as a pejorative that describes decisions that the speaker perceives to endorse a particular view. But I think that the term is overused. It is used every time there is a decision that someone doesn't like. It's usually used with respect to a high-profile case. Was Bush v. Gore a case of judicial activism? Some say so. It overturned the Supreme Court of Florida's interpretation of its own election laws in part. I'm not going to make the case that any decision is a case of judicial activism. I'm simply going to make the case that that term is not productive to a reasoned discussion about what judges do and should do. You can pick up the Congressional Record every day. I'm not exaggerating. Every day, somebody refers to a judge or a decision as an example of judicial activism, and I assure you it is not intended as a compliment. The dialogue between Congress, at least before the new Congress, and that comment that I have just made is not a political comment, has been highly antagonistic from the perspective of judges, looking at how Congress has referred to us. The criticism of judges has been, in my view, often very mean-spirited and personal. I will talk for just a moment about a particular case that I think evidences the nature of antagonism that I think is just so fundamentally wrong. It is the case of Kelo versus the City of New London. Does anyone, other than law students, does anyone know that case? All right, let me talk just a bit about it, and I will oversimplify so I can leave some time for questions. The case essentially says it is okay under the Constitution, it is not prohibited by the Constitution for the city to condemn private property for a private enterprise. Now, the the case is much more sophisticated than that. I'm being simple about it, but just to make the point. I can't remember the Supreme Court being more subject to criticism for a case in modern times than the Kelo case. You can Google the Kelo case and you will read till the cows come home criticism of the justices. And of course, the justices didn't say, this is a good idea. They just said, the Constitution doesn't prohibit it. And they are called judicial activists for doing that. How does that make any sense at all? They're saying the United States Constitution does not prohibit this conduct. And by the way, of course, it's not the justices' jobs to say it, but of course, the response is, if you don't like it, pass a law. And that's what's happened. All over this country, states, municipalities are passing laws to prevent these kinds of takings. There's nothing that the Supreme Court did or said that would indicate that that's not constitutional. But there's this fundamental misconception about what the court did, what the court meant, and the criticism is brutal. There were actually efforts made to condemn Justice Souter's house because of this decision. Now, that is just flat wrong. And I don't mind if people criticize what we do. That's one of the benefits of having lifetime tenure. We are supposed to be immune from criticism, immune from feeling the sting. And we have lifetime tenure so that people can criticize us and we won't lose our jobs or have a reduction in pay. Doesn't mean we like it, but people have the right to criticize us, but not in a way that encourages violence, and some of these criticisms, in effect, encourage violence, not in a way that causes judges to be threatened, not in a way that suggests that judges will be impeached just because one disagrees with their decision. And all of these things have happened. There have been some high-profile cases. I observed a panel a week ago at an ABA meeting where the federal judge that was involved in the Terry Schiavo case, the judge who decided the intelligent design case, and the judge who decided the Ten Commandments case in Alabama were all on a panel, and all of them were talking about the personal experience of deciding a high-profile case where one was subject to personal criticism. And I will tell you, it was brutal. Those judges were afraid that harm would come to their children. Those judges were threatened with death threats. Those judges were having security accompany them to work. It was totally unacceptable. And my view is that the discourse has moved from an acceptable arena to an unacceptable arena. We have a structure in this country. If you don't like the decision of a judge, you can appeal. And I will tell you, as I said to Jessica, as a trial judge, I find that oh so liberating. Because sometimes in those really close 50.1 to 49.9 cases, in the quiet of my office, I say to myself, well, I really think I'm right, but if I'm wrong, they'll fix it. And that's actually gives some comfort to me that, you know, there's three other people who are just as smart or smarter than me who are going to be looking over my shoulder. And I don't mind that I get my name in the paper and a decision that people don't like, they might criticize it, but not in a way that is personal, that is demeaning to me, that is threatening to me or to my family. And people, not just lawyers, but people, intelligent people, need to stand up and say that that is wrong and come to the defense of judges with whose decisions you disagree, because you do not want our system of justice to be undermined by letting judges feel that they are in physical jeopardy because they do their jobs. And I fear very much that we are to that level today. And the use of the term judicial activism, which I will tell you is used by people on both sides of the aisle and people on both sides of political ideologies, I think is not productive. There are movements in this country that have taken comfort from these kinds of criticisms. You might or might not know that there was an effort in South Dakota called Jail for Judges that was intended to put judges in jail. If they made certain decisions in certain ways, there would be a little committee of people in the community, and if they didn't agree, they could put the judge in jail. I mean, come on. That is completely counter to what we as a free people want. We want a fair and impartial and independent judiciary, and every one of us should stand up for it every day. I will conclude by saying that my experience as a lawyer caused me to love the law. My experience as a judge has reinforced my love of the law. I think that this country went through the election difficulties, and a decision of the Supreme Court resolved the matter, and that there was no rioting in the streets, that the American people accepted a controversial, difficult decision of the justices of our Supreme Court says a great deal about the importance of the rule of law in this country. It is absolutely critically important to our remaining the free country that we are. And I would suggest to you that no matter what your political affiliation or beliefs, that you should work hard today and every day to be sure that the people that are brought to the bench are intelligent and fair people. That when we get there, most of the time, our politics really don't matter. I will tell you that if choice or pro-life is your individual issue, that's fine. The number of times that I, as a judge, will see cases that involve those issues, I can probably count on one hand. I'm 7 years a judge, I don't have a one. And to use issues of that type to determine the character of judges that we should have on the bench, in my judgment, is wrong. What you want are people who are fair and smart, who can stomach a little bit of criticism, but who should not be expected to suffer physical jeopardy. Being a judge is a great job almost every day. It's not a job that doesn't have grunt work like every other job. The pay could be better. But heck, a job where people stand up when you walk in the room and applaud and pick you up at the airport in Richmond and things like that. It's just a really good job. And my parents just act like I am the bloody queen of England, honestly. So all in all, although there are difficult moments and difficult aspects to it, it is a wonderful position that I have been fortunate to have. I miss being a lawyer, but I don't live in my ivory tower. I'm married to a lawyer. I get out there in the bar and at the bar, and make sure that I do not allow myself to get isolated. A lot of people think that to be a good judge, you have to distance yourself from the community, and although there are things I cannot do, I can't go to political fundraisers and that kind of thing, because if I asked somebody to give money, they would give it, and that's why I can't. But apart from those kinds of restrictions, I live in the world, and in my view, a good judge cannot separate himself or herself from the world in which we live and the world in which we judge. So, bottom line, I've been very fortunate to have a good career as a lawyer. I've had 7 years as a judge. I haven't got any 7-year itch yet. I'm hoping to continue in this position as long as they will have me. And with that, I will stand for questions. Yes.
Thank you again for speaking to us today. I remember during the Justice Roberts and Justice Alito confirmations, and just in general, sort of the controversy and the discussion over who the president would appoint, a lot of commentators or members of the chattering class would say that, you know, is it really not a bad idea to perhaps pick justices who have not necessarily been judges before? I mean, the Supreme Court's obviously had some history with that, former governors, senators, things like that. I was just curious about your thoughts about judges who have not necessarily had a judicial background per se, but whether if they end up in some sort of appellate or especially obviously the Supreme Court positions.
I think that, will that work? I think that the factors at the Supreme Court level are very different from the factors at any other level. There has been a serious concern expressed that the pay disparity between what federal judges make, which is by no means a slave wage, I don't mean to say that, but compared to what federal judges could make in private practice, but more particularly to what we think are comparables, such as what law school deans or law school professors make. That's a more rational kind of comparison, I think. That gap, as it has widened, a year out, my law clerks make more than I do. That widened gap is going to drive out of the federal judiciary private practitioners. And that one of the strengths of the federal judiciary has been that, in contrast to other countries such as Japan, we don't have a professional judiciary, people who are trained to be judges as a career choice, and that it is good for the judiciary to bring this mix of talent. And we've had a substantial percentage of the federal judiciary coming from private practice, and in recent years, that number has dropped significantly. So I think that at that level, I would like to see more private practitioners. The truth of the matter is that today, most of the important decision-making is at the courts of appeal, not at the Supreme Court. I don't mean that the Supreme Court of the United States doesn't make critically important decisions. But the truth is, they decided less than 70 cases last year. And so, where are all the other cases? They're all at the courts of appeal. And that's why there have been these bitter, politically motivated, and I'm using that term to apply to both sides of the aisle, fights over prospective judges. The truth of the matter is that the discussion you and I are having about the Supreme Court is purely an academic discussion, because there will never be a president who can afford to do what you are suggesting from a political perspective, because there is the specter of, fill in the blank, judge unknown quantity who turned out bad, looking at it from that president's political philosophy. You could cite people, and I could cite people, but I won't. But you know what I'm talking about, where there is someone who turned out to be disappointing given the political ideology and perspective of the president. And so that will not happen again. And the only way to keep that from happening is to be sure you are appointing a person with a long and detailed record. And record has to be in the context of being a judge, because being a judge changes you. It's not the same as you think when you're not doing it. And so if you want to know what you're going to get, not a perfect predictor, but the best predictor is someone who has written extensively and decided. Now, Justice Roberts had not been a judge all that long. He was nominated the same day that Justice Owen was nominated, who is from Texas, who I know well, who eventually got on the Fifth Circuit, but he got onto the D.C. Circuit relatively quickly. She didn't, but he wasn't on all that long. But he had a very, he had writings, he had a pretty well-defined predictor set. And I think that it is unrealistic to think that given the importance of the task, that presidents now are not going to, they're going to shy away from uncertainty. And a private practitioner is a person who is just completely uncertain. Unless you've got someone who's a law professor with a very defined set of writings that you think are really a good predictor. And there, of course, are some of those. Yes.
Thank you for coming. You mentioned earlier kind of the deplorable state of certain judges being subject to threats of violence on themselves, on their children, and that being a result of people disapproving of their actions. You also discussed how you think that, in general, making courtroom proceedings available to cameras for public consumption is a good idea. Do you think that's going to lead to more of this kind of unfortunate threatening of?
Not really. If I guess that you're right, it has that risk if criticism of the type that I am concerned with derives itself from observing the process. I think it will not. I think that a lot of this is just a misconception. If I polled the average person who knew anything about the Kelo case, about it, they would tell you, they would tell me that the Supreme Court said that it was okay to condemn your property, to take your house for a private purpose. That's what they would say. The Supreme Court said it's okay to take your house and give it to somebody else. That's what people think. And that's because they get just this top view from the news. And they don't dig, and most of those people are not going to watch it on TV either. But I feel like if it's really out there, the reality of the decision-making and the argument and the issues are teed up so people can actually see it, I'm optimistic that they would have a better view of the way courts work and what they're doing. Now, I may be overly optimistic, but that's my view. Now, it is true. I have heard it said that one of the reasons that the Supreme Court is negative about cameras in the courtroom is because most people do not know what the justices look like. And I think that is true. Probably everyone in this room does, but most people don't. And that if they are on the news, if their pictures are out there, that they are at risk. And that I would not mock that argument. But if anyone wanted to see a picture of any of the justices, it would take three clicks on the computer. So it's the information is already out there. I don't think it is a it enhances the risk significantly. Yes.
Lawyers and the law, and its more sophisticated variants between the Law and Order series versus its less sophisticated variants of Judge Judy. Do you think that those provide positive reinforcement for perceptions by the American mainstream public?
Well, I have a couple of things to say about it. I have a questionnaire that I use in every single case that I try to adjure. And one of the questions is, what TV shows do you watch? And almost all of them watch lawyer shows. And that's often very useful for the lawyers to know, because if they watch Law and Order, which isn't the kind of case I have, but I think is generally a pretty accurate depiction of how the legal process works, They may think one thing about that prospective juror. And if they watch, what was that show called? The Practice, or God forbid, Boston Legal, they may have quite another perception. And I did have, I was, in Texas, we refer, and proud of it too, to the process of selecting the jury, which in the civilized world is called the voir dire. In Texas, we call it the voir dire. And so I was conducting the voir dire, and this juror said that she watched The Practice, and she was about 7 months pregnant. And I said, you know, I saw that a couple weeks ago, and that judge actually came down off the bench and delivered that baby right there in the court. I don't do that. And she knew what I was talking about. So they, it's important to know. I think most of them just create an absolutely horrid view of what it is like to be a lawyer or a judge. I think Boston Legal is one of the funniest shows I have ever seen. My husband and I are just rolling on the floor laughing, but we know it's funny. And there's some other people that think that's the way it is, that William Shatner's character is the way it is. It's just horrifying. So, yeah, I don't think there are many good role models out there. Now, to Judge Judy. A lot of them watch Judge Judy. And so when I'm conducting the voir dire and I'm trying to get them to talk, you want to get them to talk and answer questions, I ask them a set of questions at the beginning to get them talking. Usually things like, who do you think is going to win the football game, the University of Texas or fill in the blank? And they all say, University of Texas. Like, I'm not rooting for the University of Texas, but they are. So I get them talking, and I say, I have another standard question. How many of you have ever seen Judge Judy? Raise your hand. How many of you thought of Judge Judy when you saw me? Most of them raise your hand. How many of you think that I make the same amount of money as Judge Judy? Most of them raised their hand, and I said, Judge Judy makes $19,850,000 more than me. Judge Judy makes $20 million. So they watch Judge Judy. They watch, I don't even know who some of these people are. Judge deciding your case on TV. There are about 15 of them. And people love lawyer shows and judge shows. They watch them. And lawyers need to know that. Some of those notions that those shows contribute to are very negative and undermine public confidence in the judiciary. The best thing for people to have a positive view is to be a juror in a well-tried case with a good judge. I had jurors, I had a trial in the spring of last year, 4 months long. It was going on the same time the Enron trial was, which was also 4 months long. I had a big criminal fraud case. There were two defendants in Enron, 20-something witnesses. I had four defendants and 110 witnesses. And those jurors were there for 4 months. And I think, to a person, they had a very positive experience and came out of it with a great feeling of confidence about our judicial system. So. Yes.
Thank you for coming. I'm actually asking this question from the perspective of a historian rather than a law student, but just listening to your talk, it struck me that really judges are the last vestige of sort of an aristocracy that we have. That when our U.S. Constitution was first written, you had people like Thomas Jefferson who were really trying to balance like aristocracy with democracy, and that's how we have things like the popular, the Electoral College, and senators who used to be elected by legislatures rather than popularly. All those things have sort of fallen away over time, but judges are still appointed for life. So I'm just curious, hypothetically, since it seems like so much of this discussion about things like judicial activism, whether or not it exists, and cameras in the courtroom stuff, it's like trying to, it's coming from this perception that a lot of people have that judges are sort of an anomaly in a democratic populist decide, how would you make the argument to someone who, for example, said that judges should be elected on a regular basis?
Okay, thank you. That is a subject that I can speak to as a citizen, because in Texas we elect our judges, and state judges, and I will tell you a funny story and then I'll be more serious about your question. When I was a young lawyer, the judges solicit contributions from the lawyers who appear before them. How many think that's a good idea? But they do. And so if you're appearing before a judge in a big case, and the judge has communicated subtly or not so subtly that he or she would like a contribution, generally you make one. And the only time you can feel good about yourself is in the privacy of the polling booth. I think there might have been a few times when I actually voted for someone I contributed to, but there weren't many. And I came home from work one day, and my husband and I live in a public park on the lake. We have a great big front yard, which is a perfect place to put a big yard sign. And I came home, and I had the biggest yard sign you could possibly imagine in my yard for a very poor incumbent running for election. I don't mean poor in the wealth sense. And I thought, that is just appalling that he would be so presumptuous as to put that yard sign up without our permission. So it almost took a crane to get this out. You have no idea what a complicated two-hour operation it was. I mean, I had hammers, I had all kinds of stuff, and I finally got it out of the ground and took it apart and put it in a big heap at the curb. My husband came home and said, "Where's my yard sign?" Okay, tell him we have a really big dog. And the next day, there was another one there. So that's one problem with election of judges. We had a judge, state, very good state court judge, who said that he was going to have a blind trust for all his contributions. Now, this was an academic discussion because he didn't have an opponent. He ended up not being unopposed. But all of us knew that it would not work. That as long as there were judges who were running and they would know if you were contributing, all the lawyer money was going to go there. And so it is just rank. It is a rank system. Now, if you had public financing, which you're not going to get it, but if you had it, it would take away at least that aspect of it. But there have been cases decided that restrictions on judges articulating their intentions with respect to particular kinds of issues and their orientation with respect to that, to restrict that, is unconstitutional. So it is a very unseemly thing to have judicial candidates out there discussing their views on issues that are going to come before them, in my judgment. So I personally think that election of judges is not a good idea. But I do not think that appointment of judges is a pure system either. Having gone through it, it's a very difficult system too. Who are the appointers? What do they consider? It's very hard to have a purely objective system. I think your observation that judges are sort of in a world apart is correct, and that has its good aspects and its bad aspects. I, having observed a system of election of judges, am not in favor of it. It cost to run a statewide campaign in Texas for the Texas Supreme Court more than $10 million. It's a big state, and those elections attract big bucks from... You know, there are restrictions on what people can give, but there are ways around it, legal ways around it. So there's a lot of money flying around, and I don't think that, and the advertisements in those campaigns are appalling. Alabama had the worst set of those that I've ever seen in one of their sets of elections. So they're down and dirty, and that doesn't reflect well on judges. Yes.
I'd like to say that judicial discretion is very clear. There's obviously going to be some types of cases and some questions of law that just interest you more. And I'm curious, do you ever have to find yourself disciplining yourself to go look at the ones you don't want to? Do you shift stuff over to magistrate judges, give the stuff you don't want to do to your clerks? What goes on?
That's a good question. How does it work in the inner sanctum? Yes. Sometimes you get this and you think, I can't believe I have another one of these. And I will tell you that we have many habeas cases. We have prisoner civil rights cases. Most of those are pro se, representing themselves. Most of them file papers that are handwritten. Most of them have, if I told you they had bad handwriting, I would so be understating the problem. I can't read many of them. I just can't read them. They're not legible, and it's a very difficult problem. And the truth is that most of those have legal impediments to them. Many of the habeas matters are barred by limitations under the Reform Act, and so statistically, most of those cases do not succeed. And you have to say to yourself, and I do, every one of these is the first one. And there's a case that has merit. And you cannot be dismissive of any case because of the one you've had before. And it's a constant disciplining of oneself. Sure, there are cases that are more interesting that you can spend 90% of your time on and neglect all the rest in that 10%, and you've got to measure that too. And sometimes things are hard, and so you say, well, I'll get to that later, and then it gets pushed back further in the pile, and that's all just human nature. And the clerks are supposed to come knocking on your door and say, Judge, that 6-month bad girl report list is about to come out, and that one that's been sitting on your desk for a while is on it. So you just have to do that. We in federal court send a lot of our discovery disputes to the magistrate judges, but not all of them. You can't give your decision making over to your clerk, so I don't do that. It's always toward the end of the clerkship that one time one of them will say, my decision in the X. They'll refer to one of my decisions as one of my decisions, meaning their decision. And that's when I say, what did you say? And then they catch themselves. That's what they've been saying, but they've been in their own offices when they've been saying it. In my chambers, my law clerks give me drafts, and sometimes they look vaguely like what they wrote, and sometimes they don't. But you have to make sure that you don't just gravitate to the more interesting stuff. You got to handle the whole panoply of stuff you've got. Were you looking at your watch? Because my time is
up. I'm not sure how many. I think we have time for about 2 more questions.
Okay. So. Yes.
Thanks again for coming out tonight. I don't study law, but I do study media and political bias in media. A lot of your comments tonight were really reminiscent of what I've been studying, especially on judicial activism. You said, I don't even know what that means. A lot of journalists will say, I don't know what media bias means. I don't know when people accuse me of that. And I'm wondering if you see strong parallels between those two worlds, and also how you would compare the reputation of the journalist in this country to one of the lawyer or the judge.
I guess I'm not comfortable to say that I know. I think that there is a lot of overgeneralizing about our institutions. I think that you could find instances of media bias, and I think you could find instances of judicial bias. But I don't think my own impression is that there is not an institutional frailty with either, and that to generalize from a specific problem to the institution creates a problem in public discourse. I think generally we are blessed by a free and generally fair press, as I think we are by a free and generally fair judiciary. And I think those two institutions protect the freedoms that we cherish. So I think you can find examples of media bias, And you probably could cite, as I could, some examples of where members of the journalism profession did not perform in a way that you would be proud of, and I could give you some of my colleagues who did not. But generally speaking, although I think they're similarly criticized, I think both institutions are in better shape than we are given credit for being. Yes?
Thank you, Judge. My question is dealing with your thoughts on, I would say, the common person's misconception about the judiciary. And I wanted you to comment on whether you thought that had anything to do with what I believe as one of our great democratic institutions is a jury and is a grand jury system. And it seems that as history has gone forward in this country and in other countries has been really the tightening of control over juries, particularly grand juries, about what they do, what they see, what they can investigate. And do you think that a broader conception of what a jury can do and the powers of a grand jury outside of being in the control of a prosecutor or a government official would bring more trust into the judicial system and bring a greater understanding of what they actually do through participation?
Well, I don't think that I can speak to the issue of broadening the powers and utilization of the grand jury. I don't think I'm well enough informed to comment on that. I would be concerned if you just had roving grand juries with free rein to just go out and investigate any matter that they chose. I mean, I think that has the risk of something akin to a police state. But if you mean, is there a way to engage grand jurors without them being captives of the government, I've never been in there with them. My parents were on the grand jury, not the federal grand jury, long before I was a federal judge. And they didn't issue a true bill on many matters that the prosecutor presented. I think that varies from community to community. I think that, frankly, the work of the grand jury, I think, doesn't have much to do with what most people think about jury service in this country, because I think most people don't even know what the grand jury does. I think that is a mystery institution to the average person. The jury system in this country, I think, is in relatively good shape. The Supreme Court of the United States is a pretty good booster of the jury system. There have been a line of cases recently, you're familiar with them, where judges making decisions that really should belong in the hands of the jury, the courts just slap those down left and right, particularly in the criminal sentencing arena. In my circuit, one of my colleagues used to write a newsletter, and he was always criticizing the Fifth Circuit for reversing jury decisions and disrespecting the jury. And the truth of the matter is that the number of jury trials in federal court is way down, dramatically down. And Judge Higginbotham, who's an old friend of mine, who's a senior judge now on the Fifth Circuit, has written extensively about this problem. And every time he's called me to discuss it, I've had my assistant say to him, "Can't talk to you about that now. In trial, we'll get back to you when I'm done." Oh, no, in jury trial, we'll call you when I'm done, because I seem to be in trial a lot. But the statistics are absolutely unbelievable. The actual number of jury trials in this country is evaporating to nothingness. As an institution, I think people are in favor of it, but the trials are going away. I think many of them go away because of arbitration. There's just a whole variety of explanations. I think that is a very bad thing, and I think all judges feel that way. Well, all judges who want to try cases feel that way, because, as I say, I think the jury system itself participation in it and observation of it helps to build confidence in the institution. All right, thank you all very much.